So we today are starting a new series. The series is called The Journey of the Soul, and it addresses a number of questions which I think people are rather intrigued by. I'm personally intrigued by. We'll try to address them all in stages and order. So the first piece of this is going to be, we're going to really try to address four questions over the course of the next 5 weeks. Yes, we're going to skip one for Hanukkah. And the idea, number one, is going to be, what is the soul? Number two is, what are we doing? And number three is, what happens afterwards? And what is it? Oh, there we go. Number four is reincarnation as well. So these are the questions which fascinate people in general. And I'd like to thank Baruch and Esther Weinstein, who are sponsoring today this morning's shir, for the yahrzeit of Mr. David Weiss, whose yahrzeit is going to be the 10th yahrzeit. Tonight is going to be Be'ezras Hashem, Le'ili Nishmas, Chaim Zev Ben Yoel, Nishmasai Eden. This Be'ezras Hashem, our learning, our continued conversation should be one of continued Aliyas Neshama for him. Let us start. This topic itself is something which has intrigued people throughout the ages. People have struggled to understand what is the soul and how can we experiment with it, how can we feel it, how can we sense it. People are transfixed with the paranormal, the supernatural. And so, in fact, even today, if you take a look at the most popular movies in the last few years, you will notice that one of the great themes in all the media which is selling today is the paranormal, is that there's something above, there's something beyond, there's a entity beyond what we can touch and feel. People are intrigued by this, but it goes back along quite a while. In fact, there was a tremendous explosion in discovery around the era called the Romantic era, which is roughly the 1790s all the way to the 1820s, 1830s. It was what was called the Romantic era. And it was interesting because the cohort of poets and literary thinkers at the time were actually one group of people, as opposed to other eras. Let's say the Victorian era, which was much longer in terms of literary theory and ideas, was a much larger group and covered a much further expanse. But the Romantic era was actually one group of poets on the whole, and they were actually living at a critical time in terms of expansion of ideas. So as an example, at that time, the discovery of the vastness of the universe was being increased. So William Herschel became the astronomer royal of the British Empire, was discovering with his telescopes ideas and the expanse of ideas which were never before known, of just how vast the universe was on the macro level. There were trips going into the darkest of Africa at this point in time, and Mungo Parks was going down into the heart of darkness, coming back with discoveries of people, of perspectives never yet been known. Humphrey Davies was at this point in time using the process of electrolysis to differentiate different molecules, starting to understand the beginnings of the periodic table of elements. There was a huge discovery, explosion to discovery in the sciences, and it was reflected in the literary theory at the time. One of the areas of discovery, one of the areas of adventure, was the human body. And there were a number of physicians who were doing more and more experimentations with the anatomy of the human being. And as this was going on, there became a debate over the topic of what's called vitalism. The vitalism debate actually revolved around trying to measure the soul. Is what gives the human being vitality? And so at this point in time, in the early 18-teens, one very famous doctor, whose name was Sir William Lawrence, who was the first baronet there's actually a number of William Lawrences till recently, actually. He was a British surgeon, English surgeon, became the president of the Royal College of Surgeons, so a very respected physician. And at this point in time, every element of the human being, of the body, was being analyzed. People were being dissected, bodies were being exhumed for dissection, whether legally or illegally as such, and there was this greater awareness of what made up the human being. And his observation from a very scientific standpoint was that if you could not find it, it was not. And so he says very famously in his book, which is called Lectures on Comparative Anatomy, Physiology, Zoology, and the Natural History of Man, he famously says the philosophical doctrine of the soul and its separate existence has nothing to do with this physiological question, but rests on a series of proof altogether different. These sublime dogmas could never have been brought to light by the labors of the anatomist and the physiologist. An immaterial and spiritual being could not have been discovered amid the blood and filth of the dissecting room. Which essentially means to say is, what I see is what I get, and I've not yet been able to find where you store that soul. Right? So don't tell me there is a soul. Maybe you can argue philosophically speaking, but technically speaking, what I've been able to see, what I've been able to put onto the operating table, I've never seen anything of that sort, and I can say that unequivocally. He was obviously a very brilliant man. And there was a lot of debate on this, so on the other side was the Quarterly Review in 1819, which was a conservative, religiously conservative publication, came out very strongly against Sir William Lawrence. In fact, his predecessor, Abernathy, was clearly a conservative, so there was a great debate between him and his oversight, and which was became very public. The Quarterly Review talks about him and says, we at the Quarterly Review would ask that what it is that Mr. Lawrence, who is generally in the habit of smiling at the credulity of the world, modestly requires us all to believe that there are no more fully developed than the other. Sorry, then there's no difference between man and an oyster, other than that one possesses bodily organs more fully developed than the other. That all the eminent powers of reason, reflection, imagination, note the spelling, and memory, the powers which distinguish a Milton, a Newton, a Locke, are merely the function of a few ounces of organized matter called the brain. Mr. Lawrence considers that man, in the most important or characteristics of his nature, is nothing more than an orangutan or ape with more ample cerebral hemispheres. So the recorded review is saying is, how do you explain the sophistication of humankind if all you're saying is what you can find is an operating table and there's nothing else? So this debate was a very, very intense discussion at the time, specifically in the discovery of the developed anatomy of a human being. Where is the soul? What is the soul? Where does it live? In fact, one of the patients of Sir William Lawrence was a man by the name of Percy Bryan Shelley. Familiar? Yeah. Right? So he was one of the romantic poets. In fact, he was perhaps the leader of this cohort, or perhaps one would even call it a commune. And he was very much in the school that there was no soul, and his poetry reflects that. Now, he himself committed suicide at a certain point and disappeared out to sea on his boat and was washed ashore and re-identified later on. But he was married to a person by the name of Mary Shelley. In 1817, she wrote a book called Frankenstein. And Frankenstein is not the monster. Frankenstein is the doctor, Sir Victor Frankenstein. And it is worthwhile noting that this book, in fact, was an exploration of the vitalism debate. Most people think, oh, she was writing science fiction and horror. No. She was exploring the question of, can you have a creature, a being, which was created on the operating table without a soul? That was the question that she was investigating. And in fact, one of the most notable differences between the book that she created and almost every single other expression of that book, even in her lifetime, because within 10 years it had already become a play, is what's the main difference between any portrayal of the Frankenstein story and what her book actually read? Is whether or not this being could speak. When you watch any portrayal of Frankenstein, it's usually a monster of sorts, right? Grunts at the best. When you read her book, and I highly advise it, when I discovered this, when I was reading about this a number of years ago, I bought the book and I just read Frankenstein because it's worth it. We just passed the bicentennial, right? So it's worthwhile reading the book and hearing the struggles of this creature, of this being, in his own consciousness to understand who it is. That's the real question of Frankenstein. This wasn't simply a horror. There's much more to it about this being trying to find its place in society. There's a story within a story within a story. It's a beautifully written book that Mary Shelley is trying to investigate. Can there be a being without a soul? That's the question. And in fact, in the quotation, just say, as a quotation from Frankenstein, this is a description of the self-reflection. There's much self-reflection of consciousness that this being has. And he says, when I call over the frightful catalogue of my deeds, because it turns very dangerous. It becomes extremely dangerous in the rage of not acceptance, that no one's willing to accept it, and it needs love, it needs compassion. When I look at the catalogue of my deeds, I cannot believe that I am he whose thoughts were once filled with sublime and transcendent visions of beauty of the world. But it is even so. The fallen angel becomes a malignant devil, yet even that enemy of God. And the man and his friends and associates in his desolation, I'm quite alone. He is dead who called me into being. And when I shall be no more, the very resemblance of us both will speedily vanish. I shall no longer see the sun or stars or feel the wind play on my cheeks. This was said in the northern reaches of Iceland, where the being finally meets Viktor Frankenstein again. This is worthwhile reading the actual book itself. But this was an investigation of the subject, because this was the debate on the table at the time. And the debate has not ceased. So in 1907, there was a New York Times article which came out about a particular doctor by the name, who lived up in Massachusetts, whose name was Dr. Duncan McDougall. And that really was his name. And he performed a number of experiments where he wanted to know is what is, in fact, the weight of the soul? Can you measure it? So now, I don't know if these kind of things would be allowed today, but he took 6 terminally ill patients and he put them on an apparatus where he created a very sensitive scale that the apparatus that they were on, and he accompanied them through the process of dying. And at the point of death, which, of course, is very hard to discover precisely, he was able to measure the difference in weight between the human being as alive and the human being as dead. And he tried to control for various other questions about whether it's release of liquids or whether it's release of air, all the different, or the moisture which evaporates around the time of death. And controlling for all of those, he came up with the conclusion that, in fact, that there was a difference of 21 grams between a person who is alive and a person who is dead. Now, there's much questioning in the scientific community as to the ability to replicate the experimentation that he did. Of course, today, legally, it would be a nightmare to even think about that. But he claims to have afterwards taken 15 dogs on the point of death and did the same thing and found no difference in weight. So his argument was famously, and this is a New York Times article, 1907, April, is that the human soul weighs 21 grams. Just recently I read an article about a professor from Israel, from Bar-Ilan University, who was trying to explain that, in fact, consciousness itself is an expression of the human mind, and trying to explain in physical terms consciousness. This question of the soul is something which is a burning question for humanity, trying to understand ourselves. And I think that it's worthwhile appreciating that perhaps we're using the wrong school or methodology of thought to address the question. Because there's many ways that we have knowledge. One methodology of acquiring knowledge, which today is the predominant in the scientific Western world, is discovery, right? So I experiment, I create a null hypothesis, I use a scientific method, and I'm able to garner information by experimentation. And that is very valid, and we have tremendous respect for that, and Chazal do too. However, there are other ways of attaining knowledge as well. And in Judaism, one of the predominant ways of attaining wisdom is not through experimentation, but tradition. Tradition means to say is that we are able to know what we know because there was a transmission of ideas which arrived intact today, which is agreed upon across the board. And that's not because I experimented, but it's because I was given that knowledge. And it's important that although the scientific community will perhaps poo-poo this idea, because if I can't prove it or replicate it, then what value is it to me? But a lot of Judaism rests upon this other, we'll call it silo of information gathering or ideas. And we're going to look into that because, ironically, the tools of measurement are feeble when it comes to the physical tools of measurement, when it comes to something which is clearly not physical. So William Lawrence, Kvoido Bimkoima Munach, right, with the greatest of due respect, you're using the wrong tools to measure the right substance. Put it that way. So let's try to look into the realm of Judaism, what the Judaism tells us, and what tradition tells us as well. So we start at the very beginning, literally the beginning, Bereshis, Genesis, where we're told in the first chapter of creation, about the creation of man, we hear a number of strange things when it comes to the creation of a human being. So we're told in Source 5, this is in the first paragraph of Bereshis, Vayomer Elokim na'aseh Adam b'tzalmeinu kidmusenu, we let us make man in our image, likeness, and he will rule over all the other creatures in the world. And this being will be in charge of everything else that came before it. That Kosh Baruch Hu created the human being by male and female. So there's a lot of interesting questions to talk about when it comes to this, when it comes to the human being. But the first basic question when we talk about the creation of human beings over here is the strange word that's used in describing it is na'aseh, which literally is translated as let us create. Right, so the question of Tov HaTam Memorial is who precisely was God speaking to here? Like who was on the committee? Right, so that's the question that arises. And Rashi famously tells us that Rashi says he was consulting with the Malachim. He was consulting with the angelic host. There's actually other versions of the Midrash that he was consulting with values itself. That means to say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu consulted with Rachamim, with Chesed, with Emes, with Shalom, and said, is the human being worthy of creation? When it comes to these values, is the human being going to uphold these values? And there was a debate between the values, right? MS was and Shalom were not so. Hang on. Let me get this step by stage by stage. Okay, so let's just sort of take things step by step. But it's worthwhile noting first of all that Rashi is making a point, and that he says that comes a tremendous cost for this description of creation in such a way. Because what's the cost? What's the misunderstanding possibility? So more than that, in Christianity, Christianity says that actually there's a triad, right? There's three folks out there. So therefore they say, look, it's clearly God's clearly got multiple dimensions over here, and there comes that risk which the Torah knew about. But nonetheless, Rashi said that the value of this idea of humility and creation, so to speak, supersedes the risk of the misinterpretation. Just before going further, this is not our topic for today, but it's worthwhile thinking about this idea that all creation thereafterwards is going to be with humility and the need of another person. Procreation itself is an act which requires humility from the side of both partners to create. Just worthwhile thinking about that. God made it such that we are not a self-generating, and we need each other. And we need the humility to need each other in order to create. Just worthwhile thinking about the replication of that process. But nonetheless, it says the Ramban that Hashem is not speaking to the angels. Hashem is not speaking to the Midos. You know what Hashem is speaking to? He's speaking to an entity which we've already met explicitly in the text. Take a look at Source 6. This beautiful idea, and this really sets the framework for our discussion. Omar ba'odam na'aseh kolomar ani v'ha'aretz hanizkar nizkeres. Who's God speaking to? The earth itself. Why is he speaking to the earth? Because if you look at the previous psukim, when it talks about the creation of fauna, of the animal kingdom, where does it come from? Toitzei ha'aretz. It comes out of the earth. Now, to that we say, oh, well, the deers weren't just jumping out of the earth. What it means on a more sophisticated level is that the molecular elements, is that the basic carbon structures of a carbon-based life form, which comes from the terra firma, the basics of the building blocks of the earth that we have, the human being has a component of that. But, right, so the human being is that, ultimately. Ultimately, the human being is a molecular structure. We know the shape. We know the chemical structure of the DNA, of the RNA, of the ribosomes. We know that. And where does that come from? That's all found in the environment around us. But God was saying, I'm going to take all of that. I'm going to take everything else that we already have, that's already been expressed, and I'm going to partner with it, providing the spiritual partnership to the physical platform. That's what's going to happen to me. And this did not exist beforehand. So the partnership between the sublime and the terrestrial, the ethereal and the earthly, is what's occurring in the creation, which is very helpful. So therefore, William Lawrence can measure the one part of the human being, meaning the container, can measure the vehicle, but will not be able to measure God's partnership because the equipment is not sufficient to appreciate that. So let's take this one step further. So now, that's the first stage of this experience. Now, so you say, okay, the other piece which is a little bit troubling in this whole section over here is that Hashem says that He's going to make the human being. But Salmeinu Kidmuseinu, and in fact it's reiterated, but Tzelem Elokim in the next pasuk. So the vision or the image of God. So you say to yourself, what does that mean? You know, do we look like God? And in fact, in many Christian renditions, you know, there's this idea of this, you know, some of us are stuck with this image of this large, benevolent, grandfather-like figure with a white beard and glasses floating over the earth. Right, that's not God. God is not a grandfather-like figure who's observing things, you know, from the side. And so much of our distortion has come from that. So, what does it mean to be an image of God? God doesn't have an image, because the moment you have an image, why God is an image antithetical to God? Why is that a problem?
That would make it finite.
Right, any image has a border. Has an outer limit. Anything which has an outer limit is contained, and in fact, it can be subdivided. And you can now understand all the particles. But there's no God is not subdividable. God has no limits. You say no. So how can God be big? Well, it's like, well, as big as the universe. Well, there's the galaxies are huge. Yeah, God's bigger than that. The point is that God is bigger than anything we can imagine. God has no outer edge. There's no image which can capture Him. So what does it mean to say that a human being is the image of God? What is the image of God, and how is the human being reflecting that? Because the human being very clearly is limited, has a border, and is subdividable. So how does that work precisely? The Torah is specifically to identify this element. So some of the Mepharshim try to avoid this, say sidestep this, like Rashi. Take a look at the question that Rashi is actually answering when he says the following statement. Rashi says, "What's Betzalmeinu mean? Bitfus shelanu." Can anybody translate that? What does that mean literally when Rashi is explaining this? Here Rashi is interpreting the word Tzalmeinu. What does that mean? What's Tefus Shelanu? Right, Tefus is a mint or a mold. What's Shelanu? Ours. So what's Rashi essentially saying?
Doesn't belong to Him.
Right, so whose image? Our image. God didn't create in His image. God created in our image. So well, what's our image exactly? Says Rav Yosef Bechor Shor. This is on the sort of Pashtanim camp. Rav Yosef Bechor Shor says, well, at the end of the passage, we're going to hear some of the functions he needs to do. Right? So he's going to need to be in control of, so to speak, shepherding, stewarding creation. So if that's the case, there's certain physical needs for the creation of the human being. So Hashem is going to create the human being who's able, this being will have the ability to do its mission. And that requires limbs and vitality and muscles and body mass and all the things that are necessary for that. That's Betzalmeinu. Meaning to say Betzalmeinu is in our image. What we're getting confused with is we read it as Naaseh, that's God speaking to whether it's the earth or the angels, right? And we think that Betzalmeinu refers to that. No, Betzalmeinu refers to us, right? In what we need to fulfill our function. That's the way that Rashi does this. Rashi is sidestepping this question because the question is too large, right? How could you possibly talk about the Tzelem Elokim if there is no Tzelem Elokim? That there is no image of God. There's no likeness of God. That's what the Mepharshei HaPshat do, and you can understand what Rashi is answering. But there are many who say, no. This question should be taken very seriously. And we should try to understand what does it mean to be in the image of God, because this relates to who the soul is, what we are. Yes, Shelley. You're right. You're right. It becomes harder to sustain such a theory. You're right. But nonetheless, this is how some of the Mepharshim address this. So the truth is that a lot of Mepharshim try to explain this. So for instance, Or HaChaim HaKadosh says, if you look in source 9, he says, "Efshar shiyachavein lomar shiyeh bo tzad harachamim tzad adin afil bohem darche adin v'darche harachamim la'asher yikonu v'havein." Says, so you know what it means to be in the image of God? It means with the values of God. And what are two of the values of God that are intention? Are mercy and judgment. And by the way, most of our lives is trying to put the pin in that spectrum, if you think about that. How many times are we too demanding? How many times are we too lax on ourselves, on those around us, on the people in our relationships, on our employees, on our employers? We have to make decisions on a daily basis where our value system is called into account. Says Or HaChaim HaKadosh, what does it mean? Betzelem Elokim, the image of God, it refers to the values of God. Now, by the way, in the Sfiros, just to be aware of it, Nesiros appear in triangles, right? So it's the first two are Gvura and Chesed. Those are two values in tension. Then there's Tiferes, which is in the center. So the human being is made up of three sets of triangles, essentially, of values. And so the Or HaChaim is identifying the first set of values that are in tension. So what does it mean? It's not referring to God's image, so to speak. It's referring to God's idea system, which is in bronze. That's Michael, yeah.
I was just going to say, there's the two different verses to Kusenu, is whether you're drafting off of God, that you're going to have the quality of Chesed and Din, or you're going to say man is going to be composed in a way that he can, it's in the physical structure of man, which was the first one you mentioned, about God.
Yes, so there is an element of both. The Defus and the Tselem are correct. And ultimately, the next pasuk only refers to the Tselem, interestingly enough. Nachman, yeah?
It comes Adama, and then Adam, and then Dam, and then you have the Aleph, which is Hashem. So it seems to me that it seems to be just a trail of one going
beautiful.
Up to the other.
That's beautiful. That's really beautiful. I never thought about it from that perspective. Right, so there seems to be moving upwards. There is another element to it, and I want to come back to the name in just a second, because there's another element to it, but I've never thought about it from that perspective. That's almost like a pyramid of ideas. There is another element to the name, which is also fascinating, because we have to see a composite being. Why do you name it after one part of the being? Which is interesting to think about. That's what the Or HaChaim says. He says it's a value system. The Mishneh Chachma says that it's, Rav Meir Simcha Devinsky says it refers to our ability to choose, our consciousness to be able to make choices. So whereas an animal is programmed and has an algorithm to be able to, you know, to sleep, eat, hunt, and reproduce, a human being has the ability to say, I want to do that, but I'm not going to do it because it's not morally appropriate at this point in time. I'm not going to eat too much. I'm not going to engage in this relationship. This is not, there's an ability to be able to choose, which is godlike in the sense that God chooses, whereas animals don't make too many choices. Even the choices that animals are making are essentially inbuilt in terms of their algorithm and their instinctual needs. So another element of values, which is talked about. But I'd like to drive a little deeper. This is a very deeply spiritual idea, which is very important to know. So we're going to spend a little bit of time looking into the thought of the Nefesh HaChaim, who was Rav Chaim Volozhiner, who was a student of the Vilna Gaon. And he wrote a book which has four gates. The first of the gates, the Shar Aleph, refers to this topic in general, which is the topic of the soul, who's the human being. And it's fascinating, at a certain point in his work, he turns to the reader and says that if a person were to really understand this, they would never ever feel humble as a human being or never feel that their capacity to change the world is limited. Because sometimes I think that today, in today's society, you walk outside and you see the way people are dressing. We're not talking about the minimalistic, we'll call it, perspective of dressing today, but more the laissez-faire, almost careless way of dressing is what I'm referring to. People walk around out today almost like in pajamas. They walk around as if there's no sense of self. And if people were to really learn the Nefesh HaChaim and understand the magnitude of what it means to be a human being, we would treat ourselves a lot more respectfully and try in terms of understanding who we truly are. He actually says, he doesn't mention the pajamas, but he does mention the idea of self-value in understanding this. So the first shahr gets progressively more and more complex, but a few pieces from it. He points out that if you notice that, what is the tselem, the image is of which name of God? Elohim. So it's very important. God has seven specific names that are used in the Torah. The name used at least in chapter 1 is Elohim. So he says, well, what does Elohim mean, literally? What does it mean when you refer to Elohim? Actually, there's a word Elohim which refers not to God. And that refers to judges or based in or a power or entity. Right? So this is used in the Torah else as what's called Elohim Chol, when it refers to powers or judges that are not referring to the divine. But when it's appropriate to the divine, Elohim, then there is known in Halacha, the Shulchan Aruch talks about this in Simon Hay and Shulchan Aruch, when you say, Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Olam, what does it mean, Elokeinu? What do you mean by that word? It refers to, in Nusach's Eidot Mizrach, this is actually printed on the top of every page, Baal Kochot Kulam. All of power in the world pyramids up to God. God is the in charge of all power. All power is vested in Him. Any other form of power is derived from His power. Idolatry is the mistake where you start serving a subsidiary, right? That's where it comes from. So when we talk about Elohim, it means to say the master of all power. How far does this go? It says the Nefesh HaChaim that God's creation differs from that of human creation in that let's say I have a carpenter. Very famous example. The Tanya also talks about the same idea, contemporaries. That let's say I have a carpenter who fashions the most beautiful of tables, and he puts out this beautiful table, sells it on market, and the next day is hit by lightning, right? The carpenter's gone, right? He is now evaporated. So what happens to the table? Does the table disappear? Of course not. That was yesterday's work, right? So future tables may not have the opportunity of coming to the world under his tutelage. Or no, he will no longer be able to bring future tables into the world. But the table that he created was here. When it comes to God, God's involvement with his creation, even after the completion of the creation, is still constant. Which means, as we say in the Kriya Shema every morning, in the Birkas Kriya Shema, I say the words we use, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Oisei Ma'asei Bereshis. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is doing, creating. So what do you mean creating? Creation was. So the way that Nefesh HaChaim understands is that God is sustaining a certain spiritual energy which allows the universe to continue to remain in existence. For God to pull the plug from that, then instantaneously there will be a collapse of that space. Yes.
The difference
between Yesh and Yesh. Right. Ex nihilo and continued creation. And his argument is that God's continual creation demands the energy flow all the time. That's what it means when we say Bala Kochas Kulam, when we talk about Hashem controlling all of energy. Then he says, and that's what it means, Betzelem Elokim. So what does that mean precisely? Meaning, in a certain way, the human being has the same capacity of continued creation as the Creator. That's what's being conveyed to us over here. So you say to yourself, what does that mean precisely? I don't feel very much like I'm doing that, right? We're all trying to work out what dent we're living in, leaving the world behind us, right? But do we really think of ourselves as that informed, continued creator? Says the Nefesh HaChaim, we're going to take a look at this little piece inside, because it is worthwhile looking at it. We're going to take a look at the bottom, page 5, where he makes the following observation, the last paragraph. He says, Kein bedinyon ze kivyachol barahu yisporach es ha'adam. Hashem created the human being in this same likeness, v'shlitoi al ribei rivavon kochois v'alamois en mispar, by giving him control over uncountable universes. U'mosrom b'yadoi she'ehu hamedaber, u'manhigoi som al pi kol pirtei tnu ois ma'asov v'diburov v'machshev oisov v'kol sidrei hanagosov heinatov olehepech chasashon. Everything that a human being will do will have impact upon all the worlds that he is connected to. Kiba ma'asov diburov, through his actions, his speech, u'machshev oisov, those are three modes of expression, ha'tovim u'makayem v'nosein koyach v'bekam ha'kochos v'olamois elyonim ha'kdoshim. You give extra spiritual energy in those upper worlds. As he quotes the pasuk, Hashem gives us that ability. And he goes on to say, what is a human being called? A builder? Because a human being is building the world through their actions. Just understand this as he goes on to explain it, but the way that I understand it, sort of, if you want to think about an image, is that this world in general, the energy flow is down. Now, down is a bad orientation because we think of heaven's like spiritual up and physical down. It's helpful orientation, but it doesn't mean that, especially as we've discovered what's in the heavens today. That's not exactly what's going on. We'll call it inwards to outwards, but that's harder for us to understand. But as we move from the spiritual realm to the physical realm, there's a flow of energy downwards, essentially to the physical realm. We're the bottom container of the energy of that is being essentially moving downwards from the spiritual realm, which gives energy to the world that we're in. All energy moves downwards except for one, meaning to say, when you have a rock, when you have an animal, when you have a plant, that's the receptor of a particular energy flow, a divine energy flow which is sustaining it, like that table in a certain sense. And the human being is also a receptor. The human being is the only creation which his actions are actually wired such that it sends energy back up, which means to say that the human being has the ability through an action, through a word, through a thought, to be able to actually change the way the circuitry is working. Upstairs, it goes back up, and then it reconfigures down, which means that to say that our actions have a celestial impact, which comes back down in the umbrella surroundings, generally speaking, that we are it as well. And that's why says the Nefesh HaChaim of Velojna, that the human being was created at the end of creation, because wired into him, wired into her, into the creation, is the rest of creation. Every other element of creation is, so to speak, connected. So like, so you move a finger, and it's sort of setting out circuitry in terms of the upper worlds. Just to realize the significance of Sefer Yetzirah, which refers to, you know, one of these Kabbalistic books, is all it is mapping out the human form. Right, so it's just understanding. When you read these ideas and read the Sefer Yetzirah, and you talk about, you know, the spheres and the seven spheres all matching, mapping out onto each other. There's books that talk about this, and they talk about the actions to be done with the right hand with a certain intentions on a day X. I mean, we're talking about very high and lofty ideas, right? But the point is that we are wired to have that control, even though perhaps we ignore that possibility. So this is part of what Tselem Elokim means, is that we are replicating the continued creation because we are manipulating it through our actions as well. With tongue-in-cheek, I remember there was a meme that was going around a little while back, which said anybody who thinks that they cannot change the entire world should really eat more raw bat. Anyway, so the impact of one human being on the world, according to at least that conspiracy theory. But the point is that we do have an impact. We have the ability to be able to change the world around us. How so? Because we are wired as such. Even if perhaps we're not cognitively aware of the impact of our actions, at least spiritually speaking. So you say, okay, but that's the Tselem. So you say, well, what's that called? What do we call that? That Tselem? How does that look like in the human being? What does God precisely inject into the human being, which reflects this? So we have to move to chapter 2, where it talks about that. And in Bereshis Bayes, we're told that in source 12, Vayitzer Hashem Elokim Esod. Notice the infusion now of another name of God. The Yud name Yud Kei Vav Kei. Esa Adam Afar Min Adam. I say how God fashions the human being from dust of the earth. Vayipach ba'apov nishmas chayim vayi adam lenefesh chaya. Hashem blew into, so to speak, literally blew into into the human being this nishmas chayim. So now we have the name for this entity which reflects this, we'll call it secondary creation, right? There's the terrestrial creation and the celestial creation. What's the celestial creation? We call that nishmas chayim. And there's another word in the same passage which also is used here, which is nefesh chaya. Right, notice that both of them have life. They're both related to being alive. That would mean to say that when a person is dead, those you can't see those anymore, right? So that there's nishmas chayim, there's nefesh chaya over here. In fact, if you look at the rest of Tanakh, there are other names given to this as well. What's another very famous name given?
Ruach,
right? Ruach, toshuva elokim asher nesana. The in Koheles, the idea of the spirit. Again, all of them seem to be related to breath. In fact, Kabbalistically speaking, what's called the way the Zohar describes this is that that a person who blows midide nofach, which means to say that God is blowing literally from part of him, you can imagine the breath of God is in the human being. Right now, that doesn't mean to say you can deflate the human being. That image doesn't hold. But there's an element of godliness which is blowing into the human being. So much so that this image is taken very critically seriously. So, as an example, in the continuation of the Nefesh HaChayim, the image is set up as the glass blower. Right. So, if you imagine the glass blower who's using a pipette or a pile, or some sort of pipe, we actually went in Sfat to. Glass blowing is very worthwhile doing. It's quite an amazing process to watch. There are demonstrations of how this happens. It's really a remarkable experience. But when you watch it, when you watch the blower who's blowing through a pipe into the glass, you see the glass expanding, right? So there's three pieces. There's the breath, so to speak. There's the pipe through which the breath is growing, and then there's the container which is absorbing the breath. Those are as understood Kabbalistically as what's called the nefesh, the receptacle, the ruach, the pipe, and the neshama which is going through it. So just to understand in terms of the relationship of the human being to God in this is taken very seriously in this, which leads to the constellation of what's called Naran, which is the acronym of nefesh, ruach, neshama moving upwards. Nefesh is the receptacle, the lowest aspect of the human being's soul. The ruach connecting it to the neshama, which is literally the breath of God, which is the something celestial put into the human being. That was the Naaseh Adam. That's the way it's generally understood in the most basic framework. There's multiple other tiers, but that's the most basic framework. The Malbim points out a very interesting. The Malbim has a number of incredible essays, which are talked about over here, on this topic. And I'd like to just identify a few pieces that he talks about, which are worthwhile noting. He makes note that there are different words used to describe the creation process. Do you notice that we encountered two of them already in the psukim that we looked at? One is naaseh, which is asiya, fashioning. Another word is yitzira, right? Vayitzer es ha'adam. That's also formation. And there's another one is bria, vayivra, and he created. So the Malbim points out that these are actually three stages in creation. Bria is the earliest of the stages, which is ex nihilo, something which didn't exist beforehand. Yetzirah is taking that which exists and fashioning it into something new. And Asiyah is essentially the completion of the formation of that object. Okay, so if you trace these through creation, you'll see a lot of interesting observations. Because in the human being, we hear all three of them. Do you notice that? Nase Adam, Yitzer Asam, Yivres Adam. So we hear all three of them by a human being, which means there must be different parts to the human being. So he traces an interesting thing back, and he says, when you go back to the animals, you also hear about Bria, Vayivra Elokim Es Hataninim Hagdolim. God, ex nihilo, created a new life force, which is not aquatic, not a bacterial form of life, but bacterial is included in this, is a life form which is actually able to move, and that is the Taninim Hagadolim. It was aquatic. And the Malbim points out that you don't see that by any terrestrial animal. There's no Vayivra by any terrestrial animal, because once life force was given to that which was aquatic, then it was just fashioning, which came to the next stage. That's very fascinating from an evolutionary standpoint, just to be aware of what the Malbim is actually saying there. Now, he wasn't relating to evolution, but that's fascinating in terms of the original Bri'ah of, we'll call it animal life, starting in the waters, moving to Yetzirah and Asiyah on the earth form. That's the observation he makes. So therefore, he says, when it comes to a human being, any form of Yetzirah or Asiyah is essentially referring to which part of the human being is the body, which was already essentially an advanced primate, right? Which is what many people will argue today. So Hashem takes that primate, takes it to the next level in a Yetzirah or even Asiyah fashion. But then the Bria part of it, says the Malbim, must refer to something which doesn't exist, which is the soul, right? The Neshama doesn't exist beforehand. So yes, we can point to the fact that the human body seems to be, you know, opposing thumbs. Isn't that fantastic, right? Look at that. The monkeys also have it. Yes, you're right. That's good. That's the Asiyah part of the human being. Good. You noticed that. That was very good, scientists. Now we need to move on to the next part, which is there's a Bria. There's a part that you don't have beforehand. That refers to the Nase Adam, the partnership between the celestial and terrestrial. And that's the piece that you can't measure quite so easily, which is happening over here. You need to understand the convergence of those forces. Now, let's take it one step further. It says the Malbim, you'll notice that there's this, the Nefesh piece over here is interesting because an animal also is called a Nefesh. The animal also has this element of Nefesh, which is the lower reaches of the soul. What does that look like in an animal? What does that look like? It is instinct, right? So human animal has been pre-programmed, has got a vitality to itself. Without getting into the vitalism debate, animal has vitality. It is alive. It will fight for its life at all costs. That is the expression of nefesh, which is the lowest expression of the soul. And by the way, human beings do that all the time, and some of us think of ourselves only as a nefesh, right? In those terms, that element of the nefesh, he says, is worthwhile comparing and contrasting to the expression of it has in the human being. So when it comes to, the Malbim says that, you know, it's interesting. And when it comes to this element of the human being, we're told that we can learn things from the animal kingdom. Gibor Ka'ari, you know, Tsanua Kachatul, there's all kinds of attributes or characteristics we can learn from the animal kingdom. It says the difference between a human being and an animal in this realm is that an animal will only have one hallmark characteristic to its species, essentially. Now, yes, there might be variations within that characteristic, but there's a certain gvura to a lion which is held by all lions. There's a certain zrizut which is held by the tzi, by the gazelle, which all of them have. Whereas when it comes to a human being, there are different human beings, and different human beings emphasize different characteristics at different points in their lives, and they're able to choose one over the other. So the human being has a little more, we'll call a more composite or complex reality of nefesh. More than that, an animal will always express a characteristic when it relates to a very necessary function. So whether that's food gathering, whether that's evolutionary success in terms of reproduction, there will be a certain hallmark characteristic for a need. But it's not going to overplay that need excessively when it comes to human beings. Human beings will sometimes use their characteristics excessively to the point of beyond the natural need for survival. In fact, to sometimes the point of self-destruction. Human being will be able to do this. So the Ramalim says that yes, there is an element of nefesh which the human being shares with the animal, but it's more complex. In fact, he says that's why if you notice the difference between even the description process of the creation of a human versus an animal, it says the words it uses by an animal is Vayitzer min ha'adama kol chayas ha'aretz. That's not on the soul sheet. Hashem fashioned, again, this is not ex nihilo because that's already in the seas. He fashioned from the Adama. Adama literally means what? Earth. Adama actually really means mud. It's like a clod of mud, right? The animal. Whereas when it comes to the human being, it says, Vayitzer Am ha'elokim es ha'adam afar min ha'adama. Dust. What's the difference between dust, afar, and adama? The animal is attributed to the adama, mostly, and the human being is afar min ha'adama. What's the difference between dust and dirt? Clods, what?
You can't grow out of
offer. Yeah, so offer is a higher level, so to speak. It rests on the top. It's like the dust, you know, like when they're doing the leaf blowing. That's what sort of flies up, right? The offer. So the Malvim says, metaphorically, the human being contains so many different pieces of what the animal kingdom had, whereas the animal kingdom is sort of one entity. This animal is one entity in terms of material being. It's sort of like very collected, is one space. With a human being, it's lots of different pieces of the material, even itself on the material level. Moreover, when it comes to the animal creation, the Malvim points out that it's Vayitzer min ha'adama, first there's earth, and then there's nefesh chaya. When it comes to human being, it's Vayitzer Elokim es ha'adam afar min ha'adama. It's the human being first, and then it's the earth later. So a lot of discussion as to these particular details. The one piece which I think is profound that the Malvim does is he quotes a Gemara in Brachos, which is in source 14, which is very helpful for us to appreciate what's going on over here. He says, this is in source 14, where he says, Kamosha Kosru Chazal, which is essentially, I'm going to start in 8 lines in, or 7 lines in. The last of the line is Baruch Hinafshi. So it says, Kamosha Kosru Chazal, Chamisha Baruch Hinafshi, Omar David, Keneged HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Keneged HaNeshama. David HaMelech in throughout Tehillim says, Baruch Hinafshi, let my soul thank or bless God 5 times. He says, because it relates to 5 elements of the soul. Ma Kodesh Baruch Hu, here's what we're going to do. We're going to compare God to the world, and that same parallel would be the neshama or the nefesh to the body. So that's the parallel we're going to draw. As God is to the world, so to the soul is to the body. In which ways? So the Gemara says, Ma Kodesh Baruch Hu molei kol ha'olam kuloi, af neshama mamala kol ha'guf. So the neshama doesn't belong in a certain cortex of the brain. The neshama fills the body like God fills the world. Number 2. Consciousness cannot be seen, but consciousness sees. In the same way that God sees, but cannot be seen. That's comparison number 2. So calls their pulas, and there's actually another 3 which the Gemara goes on to describe. So when thinking about this, when we think about the Tzelem Elohim in a much greater picture, in the same question we have as to what who we are, is the same question as who God is. Because we're an extension of something of Him. Just we're the microcosm of the same expression of God in the world. God to the world, us to the body. The Malbim goes on to further and quotes a number of Kabbalistic works, which we're not going to get into right now. The Malbim is fascinating in this respect, about the impact of how actions of impact and affect us, but for the sake of the moment, we're going to move a little further right now because this is an endless topic in itself. I want to come back to Nachman's point. So we've talked about this idea of Tzelem Elokim and somehow what this means to be in the image of God, which God, the name of God is expressed as Balakachos Kulam, continued creation, which means that we have an element of our actions having an impact on continued creation. Well, the name of that seems to be 3 parts, is Nishmas Chayim, Nefesh, and elsewhere Ruach, each of them being a different part of it, the nefesh being something we share with the animals, but more complex, but the ruach and the neshama not being nearly as, not being in the overlap at all. But then the question is, so if that's the case, why is a person called, why is a human being called Adam? Right? Then by the way, it's interesting that the woman is later called Chava, which is nefesh chaya, which is the life force, which is much more cerebral, be it as it may. But why would the human being in first iteration be called Adam? If that really relates to which aspect of the human being? Adama, right? It seems to be the earthliness. So if we want to convey the message that the human being has an element of the cerebral, of the intellect, then we should really say something else. We should talk about the difference, not the similarity to the rest of the creatures, because now you walk away saying, okay, that's a nice animated piece of dirt and carbon-based life form, which is very nice. There's a whole bunch of them in the zoo too. Right, so why are we? Why is it different? I remember actually when my son was 2 years old, we went to the Chicago Zoo at the time, and we were like walking by the gorilla enclosure, and my 2 year old at the time, who's now Bar Mitzvah, said, why is that man not wearing a yarmulke? He is a rather hairy fellow. But the question is, so why are we called an Adam? Why are we called as sort of like a material? Why didn't we have more than that? And the answer is that Adam actually means two things. One is it relates to Adama, which is the tier below in the pyramid like you're describing. But there's another idea of what Adam means. Adama means, actually, it's like based on a pasuk in Yeshayahu. Yeshayahu describes to us in Source 15, Ale al bomasei av, I will ascend to the loftiness of those clouds, Adame la Elyon. What does Adame la Elyon mean? Yeah. I will? I'll be compared. Okay, I will match the way it's translated over here. In a certain sense, what element of the human being is Adame referring to?
Imagery.
The imagery. The imagination. I will be like a cloud. I'll fleet. I'm stuck in this cell. I'm stuck in this place. My life is difficult. And Adame le Elyon. But I want to be higher. Which means that actually the name of the human being is Adama, which is the earthliness which pulls us down and tells us that we are simply like a primate trying to sustain ourselves and our families. But there's an element in us which also says, Adam Elyon, I want to be higher, I want to be something else. And that's coming back to the Ramban's Naaseh Adam, is that the two pieces are found in the actual name itself of the human being. Obviously, this is pretty sophisticated stuff, and so it's important just to realize where this is not. So as an example, there's a movie which came out, Disney movie, we talked about this a few years ago, called Soul, which just came out. I love the fact that Disney like superimposes American culture on every part of the world, like, you know, whether it's the bottom of the sea, or whether it's rats, or wherever else whatever other movie you're gonna talk about, where you just superimpose American culture. But you can't do that to the soul, and the danger of doing that in such a way is that you it's a beautiful drama and everything, right? But in the end of the day, you get misinformed. I remember somebody just this week asked me about family purity, and she said she was shocked about this whole thing because she was listening to this comedian who used to be Orthodox or observant and kind of went off, and he was like talking about these things, and she was like, "Is that really true?" And I was like, "Actually, not. But you need to figure out a little more. There's a lot more to it. But we got to be careful by not being educated by media, because the media will give us certain images of what soul looks like, and we will look at many movies trying to focus on the paranormal media, which is trying to explore this, and they don't have the information, right? So they'll leave a lingering image of these things, but this is not really what it is." Just to take it to as we close today, because it looks like we're closing on our time, but just a few more pieces which are worthwhile considering, and we'll stop here. Now, and that is that in fact there are another book which I highly recommend in this topic is the Derech Hashem of Moshe Chaim Sato, who in the first chapter spends a lot of time on the notion of soul. We're going to spend a little more time with him next week. We're going to talk about why I'm here. That's the next step. But in his first chapter, which is, by the way, is very accessible. It's written in encyclopedic fashion. It's very. It's broken into paragraphs, sub-paragraphs, and it's got shoulder captions now, thanks to Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan, and translated and footnoted by Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan. Fascinating in general, where he talks about there's actually really five stages of basic stages of soul. There's nefesh, ruach, neshama, chaya, and yechida. And we actually are only encompassing the lower part of the soul. In a certain sense, the imagery that's used is like that we have the body is considered like a shoe. The body's like a shoe. Shoe imagery in Tanakh is very worthwhile noting because it's seen as the body, which means if you think about it, like how much time do we spend thinking about our shoes, right? So like it's sort of capturing the bottom part of the body. Now transpose that imagery to the soul, right? What's the body doing? It's capturing the bottom layer of the soul, which is great. But for us to think that I know myself, right? I'm this little being. I know my parameters is a miscalculation, because the soul is much larger than the body. And the we're called the higher iterations of the soul, the higher connections of the soul, actually are not bound by the body. What happens is that there's actually times where that chain of being, who we are, can actually change. So there's times, as an example, where on Shabbos, this is the most famous example, where we talk about a neshama yesera. That doesn't mean to say there's a second soul. That means to say that long chain of the divine being that I am has an additional rung in the ladder. There's another piece there, which I can sometimes maybe sense. The Derech Hashem says it's hard for a human being to even sense when there's a movement in or out of a piece of the soul. Another place where this is relevant is when a person goes to sleep, which means that the lower parts of the soul remain tethered to the human being, but the higher parts of the human being, the higher parts of the soul, actually are allowed to transmigrate. They're able to return back to the spiritual sphere, which accounts for some elements of dreams. Not most dreams today. Most dreams are just the Shabbos challenge, right? So a lot of what we dream about is physiological. So what we did or didn't do during the day, the indigestion or the bodily pressures that we are experiencing internally. But there is an element of dreams which, if we are sensitive people and we see a reiteration of the same dream, could be something the neshama is experiencing. Now, we have to be careful about what we interpret that to mean. And there's formulas for hatovas chalom in general, making good of a dream and the interpretation of a dream, which can be found in Siddurim. But there is an element of why is that happening, is because when a person is asleep, then there's an element. That's why we say in the morning, Elokai neshama shenasata bi taharahi. And that's why we say, just as you return it to me this morning, I know this is going to happen after I die as well. So that's the microcosm of that experience of the transmigration, which happens on a daily basis, which occurs. The most profound, yes.
Was every man created with soul, or only Jews created in soul?
Such a good question. So this actually is discussed in the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, where Rabbi Akiva describes Chaviv Adam Shenivra B'Tzelem. Human beings were created with Tzelem Elokim. Chiba Yoseron Nodaslem. It's even better if they know about that. Most people don't know about it today. Then it says Chaviv Yisrael Shenikru Bonim Lamakom. So the uniqueness of Bnei Yisrael are that we are considered children of God. That is an extra element. In that mission and around that mission is an incredible amount of debate on this particular question. But the most basic idea is, of course, every human being has a soul. What is additional about Israel is unique in terms of whether it's educational, whether it's mission, whether it's inherent. That's the discussion, the debate. It's really worthwhile reading if you wanted to do more on this topic, is the Tiferes Yisrael on that mission has an incredible discussion. Is can a human being lose their right to that Tzelem Elokim? Can a human being be so depraved, so violent that they can lose their connection, in a certain sense, disconnect? That's a question which is had on this topic. But yes, that's the basic idea. You will see statements which sometimes people throw at us that Judaism considers the rest of the world, the heathens, as subhuman, because you'll see comments like Adam ki yomos ba'oil, a human being will die in a tent. Adam atem kriyam Adam ve'en avde kachavim kriyam Adam, and that doesn't mean to say they don't have a tzelem Elokim, although some would interpret it as such. That there's a number of explanations as to what that means. It's referring to tumas oil, a particular added level of kedusha that the Jewish soul has, which in its absence will therefore create a form of pervasive level of tumah. But it's not to discredit the soul of our human beings, but it relates to mission as well. It is worthwhile noting, I just want to actually close because we have just two minutes more. There isn't a discussion as to inanimate objects also having an expression of that energy as well, even though it's not felt. So so that's why when we express Hakaras HaTov to inanimate objects like stones or frogs or the rivers or whatever else we see in Tanakh, it's not just because we're nice people. It's because actually that it's the way it's described, Rav Bloch describes it in Pnine Das, is it's like a limb. A limb doesn't have its own consciousness, but it does feel, right? It's felt by, so the energy is expressed in the different parts of the world, even though it doesn't have its own consciousness. So there's an element of reflection on the spiritual entity that's in everything. The last piece, and we'll just close with this today, and we don't have time for much further, but is the image which we actually just looked at in yesterday's parasha, which I think it revolutionizes the way that we will ever see this again. When you talk about the image of the Sulam Mutzav Arzov Roshoma Giyah Shomaima, so we have this ladder, and there's the angels, and they're going up, and they're down, and going down. What does that mean? So we say, which angels are they? They're Malachi Eretz Yisrael, Malachi Chutz Laaretz, the Malachim are going up and seeing the image of Yaakov on the throne, all the things that we've learned, right? Says the Nefesh HaChaim, is that in fact the sulam is in fact the soul. The sulam utzav arza is the human soul. And the malachim oilim v'yordim boy means to say, this is quoting the Raya Mehemnya, which is a deeply Kabbalistic work, is that when a human being performs particular actions, says certain words or expresses certain thoughts, that sends reverberations back up to the celestial worlds, which has impact on the world around us and comes back down to us as well. Which means an angel is a force of nature, a spiritual force of nature, which depends on the actions we take. Which means to say that the neshama is not, we're not simply a small little, you know, box. We're a little human being of six, roughly 5 to 6 feet, you know, and we walk upon this planet. We have a much longer spiritual connection. The circuitry goes up much higher. And when we do actions, that sends pulses all the way up, and it affects the world around us. Coming back to the power of the human being as the continued creator. We are much bigger than we ever imagined. And if this does feel a little bit beyond the scope of our logic, yes, that's true. Because we are using our brains and our logic and the parameters of our touch and feel to try to understand something which is much more beyond that concept. I'll just close with a story I just saw recently about a person by the name of Dr. Elimelech Goldberg, who has an organization called Kids Kicking Cancer. He teaches martial arts to kids who lives in Detroit. Who are going through lo aleinu, most terrible of diseases. And he was describing a conversation he had with a little girl called Tali at Kam Simcha, and she they just found out that the treatment for her rare form of eye cancer had returned, and that treatment wasn't effective. And she was in a very bad place. She was speaking to him. And at a certain point, like in a beautiful childlike way, she said to him, "Can my neshama, can my soul contract cancer?" And he said, "No, Tali, your soul will never get cancer." And that for her was a turning point. She got up and she went and carried on playing with the kids. He was able to do that. And from then onwards, he started asking kids, "What is your most powerful part of your body? What's the most powerful part of you?" And children talk about their foot and their hand and their shoulder. And he said, "The most powerful part of you is your neshama, because it's beyond the reaches of everything we measure, all the pain we feel, everything that's within this world. It's important for us to expand our consciousness, to realize how much more of a person we are than meets the eye upon the anatomy table which we're being taught. That's one part of it, and that's a fantastic discovery. We should discover more. We should understand the structure of RNA so we can create CRISPR, so we can kill viruses like the coronavirus, which is how a lot of this came into being today, was genetic engineering. But in the end of the day, that's only one small part of the human being. So next week, Be'ezrat Hashem, we'll move forward into other zones. I thank everybody for taking the time to come in. I look forward to continuing the learning.